News Radio.
This paid commercial may not represent the views of Hubbard Broadcasting Incorporated or Federal News Radio. Statements and opinions of this broadcast are solely those of individual contributors or advertisers as indicated. Federal News Radio does not take responsibility for those statements or opinions and accepts no responsibility or liability for any inaccuracy, errors, or omissions reported during this program.
Interfacing complete. Please stand by. Now downloading Tech Talk Radio with Dr. Richard Schertz and Jim Russ. Tech Talk Radio, it's technology you can understand. And now, here are Dr. Richard Schertz and Jim Russ.
Welcome to Tech Talk Radio. We're in the virtual faculty lounge at Stratford University talking technology. I'm Dr. Richard Schertz.
And I'm Jim Russ.
Bitcoin is in a little bit of a hot water these days. Mm-hmm. One of their main sites was shut down for drug dealing. If you've been watching the new studios of Fox News, you'll see these giant monitors that Shep Smith has. We'll talk. These look like giant. They're 55-inch touchscreen monitors.
Uh-huh.
First production crew. We'll talk about the technology behind that. It's an interesting story, I suppose. And I'm going to talk about this, how Elon Musk, who of course is the CEO or CTO of SpaceX, is using hand gestures to design rocket parts and then 3D printing them. And, of course, it was a giant,
huge,
giant mailbag.
There's a letter in your mailbox.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, it's the one thing here that's not virtual. The mailbag is an actual mailbag.
It's an actual mailbag. And so even we talk about such weighty topics here on Tech Talk that even emails are very heavy.
Exactly, yes.
Because they're weighty. Mm-hmm. We got an email from Dick Mondro in Florida. I had an email from him last week. He says, thank you for your help in blocking pop-up ads. We talked about that last week, how to block pop-up ads. The host file from mvps.org did the trick. Because he was trying to get rid of them, and I gave him that host file that he could possibly. That was actually the third technique. So apparently the third technique did the trick for him. He also wanted to get the Tech Talk podcast in his Chrome browser.
Uh-huh.
So he installed the Google RSS reader as recommended, and now he can actually listen to the podcast right within Chrome, which is very nice. And he did talk a little bit about Weirsdale. Remember that?
Yes.
He says, well, Weirsdale did sound a little weird to me about 10 years ago, but I felt compelled to let you know after 30 years in the military and as a pilot, another 12 years in living in Michigan, where I got my doctorate and taught at the Big M University, I began looking for retirement, and I found the 6 acres of land beside a private airport in Florida, and it's in Weirsdale, and it's named after the 9,600-acre lake, Lake Weir.
Mm-hmm.
It's fresh water, and it was once home to Gator Joe, the 15-foot, 7-inch alligator that lived in Wake Weir in the early 1900s. Thank you again for an excellent tech show, Dick Mondro from Weirsdale, Florida, U.S. Air Force retired.
Well, thank you for your service.
That's right. Thank you for the service, and thanks for the email. I always like to know when stuff works that we recommend here on Tech Talk.
You know, and it's funny because now that he mentions it, Lake Weir, I didn't realize it was that big. That's the lake you see when you're on approach to Orlando Airport. You come right over Lake Weir.
Okay.
Okay, anyway, not that that matters.
There we go.
The hill of beans.
Okay, we got an email from Steve in Potomac. Dear Doc and Jim, your practical advice on how to deal with PC problems is so helpful. I'm already excited about your show in a couple of hours. I got this email this morning at 6 a.m.
Uh-huh.
He knows when I'm working on the show.
He does, because, you know.
Okay, but then he says, can you suggest a way to get rid of pop-up ads that are littering my PC and have made it slow? Thanks, your loyal listener, Steve from Potomac. Okay, Steve, you didn't listen to the show last week.
Uh-huh.
just go to the October 5th show, and you'll have all of the techniques. And basically, you can set up pop-up blocking in your browser. You can uninstall extensions that sometimes create pop-ups, or you can install a host file, which Dick Mondro just talked about, that you download from mvps.org. And all those details are on last week's show, the October 5th show. But thanks for your email, and thanks for listening.
Yes.
We got an email from Mary. Dear Tech Talk, I work as a tech writer in a transportation firm in the D.C. area. To my amazement, I'm still using Windows XP. This just makes life challenging. Now, my current issue that I'd like to know if there's a way to do spell checker with an Adobe Acrobat 11 Pro, either built-in or as a downloadable add-on. I'm currently using Adobe Acrobat Pro a lot and have not found a good spell checker yet. I did find one via Google, but it was for a Mac, not a Windows. Thanks, Mary. Well, there is a built-in spell checker, Mary, but it only checks the comments. It doesn't check the underlying PDF. And I couldn't really find any good options for checking the underlying PDF. I did find a script that will run as a batch file, and it will do spell checking on a batch of PDFs. I'm going to give a link to that, and you can just go to the Tech Talk website and pick up that link. And but he's charging $85 for it. Now, so, and I haven't tested it, so I don't know that I could really recommend it. I'll give you the link so you could check on it. Now, what I actually do when I want to spell check a PDF, I just get the PDF extension for Microsoft Word. There's also a PDF extension for LibreOffice or OpenOffice if you're using open source software. And then you can just import the PDF file into that using that extension and do the spell check within the word processor. Mm-hmm. And it's not quite as convenient, but it's cheaper. So that would be my recommendation for you. I don't know why Adobe Acrobat doesn't spell check the PDF. There's been a lot of complaints, and there are a lot of complaints in the discussion on the Adobe discussion groups about that. But, you know, maybe they'll come up with that later on. Okay. We got an email from Sophia in Woodbridge. Dear Tech Talk, I just got a new iPad and want to prepare MS Office documents on it. Are there any options? Thanks. I love the show. Well, you do have several options, Sophia, to run programs that are similar to Word, but not as rich as Word, as similar to MS Office, but not as rich, feature-rich as MS Office. Now, the documents in these particular options can be stored, say, on the cloud, say, using Dropbox would be what I use, actually. Now, actually, I have two programs. I have several programs. I just downloaded them all because I just wanted to kind of test them for Tech Talk. I did this some while ago. I've got Docs2Go and QuickOffice for my iPad. Now, they each cost about $10, and it's a complete office suite with the PowerPoint equivalent, the Word equivalent, and the spreadsheet equivalent. And I've got QuickOffice. Docs2Go and QuickOffice, they each cost about $10. And they integrate directly with Dropbox. Of the two, I kind of like Docs2Go a little better, but they're both fairly convenient. Now, Apple also sells their versions of Office, but they don't sell it packaged up. You got to buy it separately. They sell the Word equivalent is called Pages, the Excel equivalent is called Numbers, and the PowerPoint equivalent is called Keynote. But they sell each one of them separately for $10. So mm-hmm. to get all three, it's $30. Okay. So I also ordered those. But actually, I like those better.
And you can use them on your iPad.
Use them on the iPad, yeah. Huh. And so I actually use Pages. I use Keynote a lot to read all my PowerPoints. You know, that's really quite good. It doesn't have all the PowerPoint features of the latest PowerPoint, but it has most of them. It's not quite as feature-rich. And so that would be $30. So if you just want to go with a native application, those would be your choices. And I would probably go with the Apple versions, Pages, Numbers, or Keynote. And then I would use the cloud storage.
What do you think about what is the Apple word processing? I forget the name. We've talked about it before on the air. They're the Apple version of their word processing program.
So that's Pages. That is the Apple version.
Oh, okay. I'm sorry.
Yeah.
There was a problem with it this past week. Did you hear that? There was something that the people that are trying to use it on their iPhone or something like that are getting the blue screen of death when they switch over to it. And apparently there's no fix for it yet. I just happened to hear a blurb about it this week, but I wish you could provide more
details. I actually haven't picked it up. I haven't had any problem with it. I'm using them both. I'm using all of them. Cool. Now, if you want to have an actual real Microsoft Office running on your iPad, now, there is a way to do that, and I'm going to tell you about that. It's a little bit more complicated, but you can actually do that. You see, Microsoft Office is going to release a version for the iPad, but not until they release a version of Office
for the Microsoft Surface.
Ah.
And once they allow Surface to get good market share, then a little bit later they're going to bring it out for the iPad. So they're playing these competitive games.
Mm-hmm.
So the only way to get real Office, this would be actual Microsoft Office running on your iPad, is using it as using your iPad as a thin client, where you basically have Microsoft Office running on a server and you just display the page. And there are two services where you can operate Microsoft Office in a thin client mode. One is OnLive Desktop, and the other one is Cloud On. And you can download both of these applications. And they basically operate in the freemium model. They're free. You download them, and you can get 2 gigabytes of storage. And I like actually online desktop better. It looks really like a Windows desktop. Cloud On is a little bit clunkier. But OnLive Desktop, it looks like a Windows desktop. You click on it. Of course, you've got the touch screen, so you can open up Windows, PowerPoint, or Excel. And I'll tell you, it's just a native application running there. And it's the latest version of Microsoft Word or latest version of PowerPoint. Now, the freemium, what they do, though, the response time is just a little bit slow because they got shared servers there. So if you want to get, like, super quick response and you want to get more than 2 gigabytes of storage, they, of course, want you to get the subscription at $5 a month. So they get you in for free. They get you hooked on it. And so I'm going to think if you really like that, if you really do want to have the full version of Office and Excel because you want to get all of the features, you're probably going to want to go to one of those thin clients. And if you pick, we've got Live On Desktop and Cloud On. I like Live On Desktop the best. And so... Mm-hmm. And you try that free for a while. If you like it, you could just pick up the subscription for $5 a month. Now, the one disadvantage, of course, it's a full version of Word, but there's no mouse.
Ah.
So you have to use the touch screen. And so the Word is really not, so you can touch it, and you can highlight. It's just not quite as convenient as with the mouse.
Gotcha.
And I could not find a way to get the mouse to interact with it. I'm sure... There must be a way to do that, so maybe I'll do some further research. Because if I get a Bluetooth mouse, I could connect a Bluetooth mouse to the iPad, assuming you've got a mouse driver. And so technically there should be a way to do it, but I just didn't figure it out yet. But now that I've got this bug in my mind, I'll work on that, and I might have an addendum to this letter next week.
Have you had your hands on a Surface yet?
No, not yet.
I guess then you really couldn't answer the question, but I was wondering if you could do it all over again, would you go with the Surface or would you stay with the Mac?
Well, I like the iOS operating system better than Windows 8.
Oh, okay.
For a touch screen.
Uh-huh.
See, the problem with Windows 8, it's like they designed it as a traditional desktop with a mouse or as a touchpad. And it's not optimized for either.
Okay.
And so it's like Microsoft didn't know what they were doing.
Okay.
And so whereas the iOS is just purely touch.
Right.
And it's all integrated with touch. It's got all sorts of motion, gestures that work with it. And the Office just isn't that sophisticated yet.
Mm-hmm.
So they really should have forked to the operating system and had one that was purely for touch, one that was purely for mouse, and not tried to mix them. I mean, if you look at Apple, they've got a Mac operating system, and that's not to be confused with the iOS operating system on the iPad. Apple didn't try to get one operating system that works for both.
Sure.
Apple did.
Uh-huh.
And that's why they're having trouble with sales.
Ah.
So there's really a lack of clarity in their vision and the design, and that's why I don't like it as well.
So actually, you can answer the question. You wouldn't go near a Surface.
No, I wouldn't. And it's not really the technology. The Surface technology, I think, is as good as the iPad technology.
Mm-hmm.
It's the operating system, and it's clarity of vision. Microsoft, under Ballmer, has not had clarity of vision as it relates to mobile devices.
Mm-hmm.
And they're playing catch-up. Now, maybe in a couple of years, they'll have that clarity of vision and they'll have an operating system that looks good. But I wouldn't get it at this point.
Wow.
Which is why I don't have... I guess I did kind of play with it at Micro Center or something,
uh-huh.
but I can't say I've really spent much time with it.
Sure.
Okay, we got an email from Hawk and Bowie. Dear Tech Talk, I posted a wall post on my friend's timeline and noticed that I made a few spelling errors and wanted it deleted or removed. But then when I clicked the remove button in the upper right-hand corner of the wall post, the only option was it said none.
Mm-hmm.
It literally says none. I tried everything, but it says, sorry, this page isn't available. It's strange. But the wall post is still up, and I want it deleted. When somebody posts... But, you know, I don't know what to do. When somebody puts something on my wall, I can delete it. I just can't delete it on their wall.
Sure.
What's the glitch? Well, this is the glitch. You cannot edit your friend's page. You can only edit your own page.
Mm-hmm.
So the only way that this can be removed, and I hope that you didn't say something totally inappropriate that's just hanging up there.
Mm-hmm.
The only way it can be removed is you have to give them a call or send them an email and ask them to delete it. They can delete it.
But you can't.
Now, they actually can't edit it, I don't think, but they can delete it, and then you could repost it if you'd want. So you're going to have to mail them a request. And in the future, what I recommend is that before you hit send, read your post.
Always a good idea.
Read the post. Now, you can, on your own website, on your own page, of course, you can always delete it. You can always edit it. You can edit it right away, but if you let it sit there for a while, the edit option goes away, and then you've got to delete it. You just can't edit it. So it's a good question, and many people have that problem. We got an email from Heather. Dear Tech Talk, I have two websites, and I'm worried about getting them infected. You know, we hear about infected websites with all kinds of viruses. What should I do? Both sites are just HTML and are uploaded using FTP. Thanks, Heather. Well, it sounds like you've got a static website, meaning it's just HTML, and that you're uploading it just to straight FTP. That's File Transfer Protocol. That's a TCP/IP protocol. FTP, File Transfer Protocol, is the way that you can upload files to a server. And in that case, since it's a static website, the typical ways that people infect it are not going to work for them. So, but you've got to make certain you've got a good password, and you want to keep it secure, because if a hacker gets your password, they could simply start FTPing stuff into your site. They could change your files, and that's really how they would do that if they could crack your password. But that's not the most common hack. The granddaddy of all website hacks is SQL injection. Now, that's when you've got a website which is dynamic and it pulls data out of a database. Yours is not that case, but if you would have that, like if you have a blog, like WordPress, that's basically all the data stored in an SQL database, and then the WordPress front page is basically accessing that database. And in the case of WordPress, SQL injection would work if it wasn't protected. Now, SQL stands for Structured Query Language, and it's a database programming language. You've got commands like, you know, you go through, and if this condition is met, delete these files. If this condition is met, do that. If this condition is met, display that. So you can actually access the database and give it all kinds of commands with structured query language. Now, here is what SQL injection is. If people are sloppy when they create the web page, suppose you've got a form that you have to fill out, and they don't clean up the data before they send it to the web page. So suppose you put in your first name and your last name, and if they don't scrub the data, and you simply put in, say, the first name field, an SQL executable command, then when it takes and inserts what it thinks the name is into another command, you've already got an executable command, and all of a sudden, you've taken over the database with your executable command. That's called SQL injection. So what you have to do is you've got to sanitize the input. And so this is where most of the website hacks occur. The inputs are not sanitized. They're just sort of put together quickly. They work very well if you put in proper input. But if you put in improper input, it's not scrubbed. Now, content management systems like WordPress, which are SQL-based, have had to seriously harden themselves over time against these kind of attacks. And WordPress is getting much, much, much better. There have also been bugs that allow SQL injection to occur on purely content sites. So if you're using a CMS or any CMS, keep it up to date, because as people discover more and more attacks, they'll fix them up. So one thing, if you've got a CMS system, content management system, CMS, you want to always keep it up to date. And one final note, Yeah, you should really back up your site daily. I mean, I'm certain you do that. We back up ours more than once a day. So if you really get hacked and they do serious damage, you can simply restore to the last time that the site was clean.
Mm-hmm.
That was a good question,
yes.
I'm glad that you're thinking that way. It'll probably protect you quite nicely in the future. We got an email from Jim in Kansas. Dear Doc and Jim, I've contracted for 100 megabits per second internet connection from my internet service provider. The maximum speed I can get, however, is only about 30 megabits per second through Wi-Fi. When I connect the router to a LAN cable directly with my laptop right next to the router, I get about 80 megabits per second, which is close enough to me. What's up? I don't really understand this. Thanks, Jim in Kansas. Well, Jim, 100 megabits per second is actually faster than most Wi-Fi standards. Now, the earliest Wi-Fi standard, 802.11b, was actually only capable of transmitting at 11 bits per second. You know where that number came from, 802.11?
No.
There's a standards committee, and the first time the standards committee met was February 1980. So that's where the 802 came from.
That's funny.
The 11th standard that this committee has released is 802.11, and that's the Wi-Fi standard. So that's an IEEE group. I don't know how I got up on that.
And that's kind of a sidebar.
That would be an official sidebar, yeah. Mm-hmm. So 802.11b, which was the first one that came out, is actually only 11 megabits per second. And in reality, you never get the full 11. You get maybe 8 megabits per second. They had a more recent standard, 802.11g, which is 54 megabits per second. But actually, you never get 54 megabits per second. You typically get around 30 to 35 megabits per second. Because what happens is you get collisions with these packet collisions, and you can't go normally at the fastest speed. And so you probably are sitting there with 802.11g on your wireless, and you're getting 30 megabits per second, which is about what I would expect. Now, if you get the latest standard, 802.11n, it allegedly can go up to 600 megabits per second. But that signal strength really matters in that case. You've got to be quite close. Now, what could slow your 54 megabit per second down? Suppose your neighbor has a Wi-Fi in the same frequency band. You're going to have to share the frequency, man. That's going to slow down your effective bandwidth because you're going to be colliding with his packets, and you can't transmit both at the same time. So you got to wait for him to finish his transmission, and that effectively slows you down. Also, if you have mixed devices on your Wi-Fi, like suppose you've got one laptop with 802.11b, which is 10 megabits per second, and another laptop with G, the entire wireless system goes down to the slowest speed.
Mm-hmm.
So that could be the case. Now, what I do because I don't want my neighbors to slow my internet connection down.
No, that can't happen.
You see, there are actually 11 channels on these wireless, 1 through 11, and they're only three non-overlapping. It's 1 through 11, but there are only three channels that are not overlapping. It's like 1, 6, and 11 because it's kind of a wide bandwidth, and so the adjacent channels overlap. So I'm either on 1, 6, or 11. So what I do, I check what channel my neighbor is on. Like if he's on 6, then I make certain I'm not on 6. I'm going to be on 1. So I've got two neighbors, so I check what they're on. And I set the channel on my Wi-Fi so it's at a different frequency than my neighbors, so they don't slow me down.
So how do you check? Is this used for the antenna, or do you just break into the house and see what they're up?
No. I actually have a net stumbler, and it tells me.
No human interaction is needed here.
Okay. I downloaded a program called Net Stumbler. I put it on my computer. And it tells me whether they're encrypted, gives me all kinds of information about their network and everything. If I need it, but I rarely need it. I'm trying to keep the neighbors out of my network.
See? Exactly.
So I always have encrypted network so my neighbors don't use my bandwidth. So we got an email from Craig in Oakton. Dear Tech Talk, the other day we were looking at a website and were hit with this virus, System Progressive Protection Virus. And you know, we didn't even click on a link. You know, we immediately shut down the machine. And when I went back on the internet, I found what seemed to be a reasonable site describing how to get rid of it. After many attempts, I think we got rid of it. But how did I get this virus? You know, through the firewall, and I'm also running Microsoft Security Essentials. Thanks, Craig. Well, Craig, the firewall actually doesn't protect you against viruses. The firewall protects you against internet-initiated connections. If somebody from outside your network tries to get into your network by connecting with your computer using a port where they know there's a vulnerability, that incoming connection was not requested. Your firewall knows that, so it blocks it. Now, and there's a lot of malware that's constantly trying to connect to random IP addresses, and you'll probably get, your firewall is probably hit with external attacks, I'd say 10 per minute. They're just very, very all over the place. But the firewall is very good at protecting against that. This particular case, you actually requested the web page. So it was a request, and it was sent down. And so since you requested it and it's a response to your request, the firewall is going to let it come through. Now, what happened is your Microsoft Security Essentials is actually doing real-time scanning as the virus is coming down, and it will detect the virus on the way down. Now, that assumes that you had real-time scanning turned on. Now, maybe you didn't. You may not have had real-time scanning turned on, in which case it was fully enabled. But if you had real-time scanning turned on, it should have caught it before it was actually installed on your computer. Now, it also could be that you don't have the latest version of Microsoft Security Essentials, you know, because they'll release new malware. It's like a cat and mouse game. They release something new, and then Microsoft comes up with the signature for that new one, and then they update it. So you might have gotten some malware that was very recently released, and Microsoft Security Essentials had not been updated yet, and it just made it through the system, didn't detect it. I don't know which one that is. So that means you've got to make certain to also keep your Microsoft Security Essentials updated. So you want to keep your antivirus, anti-malware software updated, and you want to adjust it for real-time scanning. And then that's about the best you can do. But I think you did a very good job. Once you realized that something had gotten in your machine, turning it off was very smart business. That's the way to do it. I do that, too, if I ever get caught in that situation.
And, of course, you are listening to the Classroom of the Airwaves, Tech Talk Radio, brought to you by Stratford University, heard every Saturday morning at 9 on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM, 820 AM, 107.7 FM HD2. We will have more coming up right after this.
If it's technology, it's Tech Talk Radio. IT trends, software, the internet, and IT careers. More of Tech Talk Radio, presented by Stratford University, coming up in a moment.
Application and software developers shape our world. Those who design and build these systems are the leaders we follow. The School of Computer Information Systems at Stratford University's Tysons Corner or Woodbridge campus offers programs with a real-world, hands-on education. In fact, many of today's Stratford IT grads are working in their chosen field. Make it work for you. Stratford University. Get working. Check us out on the web at stratford.edu. That's stratford.edu. A rewarding future as a holistic caregiver or nurse practitioner. Combining the art of caring with the human science makes nursing today's breakout field. Stratford University's School of Nursing at the Tysons Corner or Woodbridge campus offers a patient-centered approach with valuable core clinical training. Stratford provides a real-world education in nursing. In fact, many of today's Stratford nursing grads are working in their chosen fields. Make it work for you. Get working. Check us out on the web at stratford.edu. That's stratford.edu.
If it's technology, it's Tech Talk Radio. IT trends, software, the internet, and IT careers. Here's Dr. Richard Schertz of Stratford University with Tech Talk Radio.
Welcome back to Tech Talk Radio. We are in the virtual faculty lounge at Stratford University, and now it is time for
Robots in IT.
And today in the hot seat is Michael Sternhart. Michael Sternhart is credited with making the first ebook and is known as the founder of Project Gutenberg, which makes books freely available via the internet.
Interesting.
Michael Sternhart was born March 9th, 1943 in Tacoma, Washington. Hart's father was an accountant, and his mother, a former crypto analyst during World War II, was a business manager at a retail store. In 1958, his family relocated to Urbana, Illinois, and his father and mother became college professors because, you see, that is the home of University of Illinois, mm-hmm. and it is pretty much a university town. His father became a professor in Shakespearean studies, and his mother went into mathematics education.
Uh-huh.
When Hart completed his four-year individual plan of study, this was an individual program that he had concocted, he actually finished his four-year degree in Illinois in 2 years, and he obtained a degree in human-machine interfaces.
That's an interesting degree to have.
Yeah, which, you know, considering at that time.
Yeah.
Now, he attended but did not complete graduate school, so mm-hmm. he was one of the graduate school dropouts. He was always into so many other projects. Now, Hart was given an operator's account with $100,000 of computer time by the operators of the Xerox Sigma 5 mainframe in the Materials Research Lab at the University of Illinois on January 4th, 1971. See, a computer account with $100,000 of computer time on the mainframe in the Materials Research Lab. The mainframe was the Xerox Sigma 5 mainframe. And he got that on July 4th, 1971. Uh-huh. It turned out that two of the four operators that operated that mainframe happened to be the best friend of one of them was Michael's best friend, and another one was the best friend of his brother. So he kind of had an inside job here.
Was it 100,000 or 100 million?
100,000.
Okay, this is a typo then.
Yeah.
I just want to make sure we got the right number. Because you never know.
Yeah.
You never know which numbers you're going to need and which facts you'll need from the
yes,
show.
Yes, indeed. It was $100,000 worth of computer time. Now, this particular computer was one of the computers that was on the original DARPANET. And it was one of the, at that time, there were only 15 nodes on the DARPANET. This was the precursor to the Internet, only 15 nodes. This was node number 15. And ultimately, that network became the Internet. And so this was one of the computing areas that was sort of at the forefront of computer networking technology. Now, he got this account on July 4th, 1971. So he was looking around for some worthwhile thing to do with all this computer time. And, you know, most people at the Materials Research Lab would have thought, okay, well, I'm going to do some materials research.
Right.
But he started thinking, he says, you know, this is hooked up to a network that maybe someday could be huge.
Mm-hmm.
So why don't I use this computer time for storing documents? So it turned out that on the day that he got the account, July 4th, 1971, he'd gone to the local grocery store, and they gave him a copy of the Declaration of Independence on sort of this fake parchment paper. At the grocery store.
Oh, because it was July 4th.
It was July 4th, 1971.
Right, okay.
So he had this copy of the Declaration of Independence, so he decided, why don't I store this document on my computer account. So he retyped the Declaration of Independence and uploaded it to the computer. And this actually was the beginning of Project Gutenberg. So he personally typed that into the thing and he uploaded it. Now, he continued to enter in documents that he typed by hand. He typed in the entire Bible by hand he typed all of Shakespeare's works by hand.
Mm-hmm.
I can imagine, this is like takes quite a degree of dedication.
Yeah.
He then did Alice in Wonderland. Most of the early postings were entirely typed by Hart. Now, Project Gutenberg was named after Johannes Gutenberg, the 15th century German printer who introduced movable type. Because before that, you had to basically form the entire page
right.
by hand carving
it. Hand carving it, right.
And he said, well, why don't I just carve out the letters and put them together?
Yeah,
so it was like a revolution in printing.
Mm-hmm.
So this was, and so the last revolution in the printed word was Gutenberg. So we thought this is going to be the next revolution. Now the project, the mission of Project Gutenberg is simple: to encourage the creation and distribution of e-books. Hart became the first information provider on the what would become the internet more than 20 years before Tim Berners-Lee invented the web. And at that time, there were only 100 people on the internet, on the network. So this was a
That's
man
pretty,
who was a,
yeah.
who was ahead of his time,
sure.
you see. Now, as of 1987, he had only typed in 313 books. You see, one guy typing in books is not the way to basically record all of the printed word that mankind has produced. He was not going to keep up with it. Now, it turned out he met some people. He was a member of the University of Illinois PC Users Group, and he was able to recruit volunteers, and they set up an infrastructure of mirror sites where they would mirror the books that he had uploaded, and he set up a mailing list, and he got other people who were interested in entering the data. And so by the end of that year, right after he made this arrangement, he managed to have almost 1,600 books entered in that year with using all these volunteers. By 1998, he was honored by Wired Magazine as one of the Wired 25.
Mm-hmm.
By 2006, Project Gutenberg offered more than 17,000 e-texts, all of which could be freely downloaded in various formats. But see, in the beginning, he was just viewed as that weird guy that wanted to put Shakespeare on the web. And of course, you know, he focused on Shakespeare because, remember, his father was a Shakespearean professor.
Mm-hmm.
You can see where that came from.
Yep.
As of December 2007, Project Gutenberg claimed over 25,000 items in the collection, and we're averaging more than 50 new e-books each week. Now, Hart has set a new goal for Project Gutenberg: to make 10 million e-books available. He believes that the future of publication lies with replicators. Remember where I've talked about nanotechnologies for replication? He thinks that we'll be able to use nano assembly tools. We talked about this with the, you know, we talked about the singularity earlier.
Mm-hmm.
Or 3D printers to be able to produce and copy physical objects like books very easily. So if you can store them digitally, you can replicate them and just create books at low cost, you know, in anybody's home. Project Gutenberg website address is gutenberg.org, gutenberg.org. Now, what is interesting, this weekend they are coming out with the brand new Gutenberg website.
Mm-hmm.
So the existing website sometimes is on and sometimes is off this weekend. Like last night when I was working, you know, normally I work on the show
sure.
in the middle of the night.
Yes.
I was working on it last night around 3 o'clock and the Gutenberg website was down.
Uh-huh.
But by 4:30 it was up.
To load more stuff into
to
it.
To load more up. Well, actually, mm-hmm. it's going to be a whole new website. So they're revamping it. So Michael Stern, because he started putting this material on in the beginning, basically at the first e-book and the first document that he loaded on to the web, and the first e-document then was the Declaration of Independence loaded on July 4th, 1971.
Very interesting.
So there you go. All you wanted to know about Michael Stern Hart, and you can go to the Gutenberg.org, and you can get... Oh, but, you know, this, by the way, these are stored in a format. You can load them on your Kindle, on your Nook.
Uh-huh.
So you can just download the books, and you can read them with your Kindle or your Nook to your heart's content.
It's Saturday morning, and you're listening to Tech Talk Radio on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM, 820 AM, 1077 FM HD2. Stand by, more of Tech Talk right after this.
If it's technology, it's Tech Talk Radio. IT trends, software, the internet, and IT careers. More of Tech Talk Radio, presented by Stratford University, coming up in a moment.
It's
time. Time to put your talents out there on your terms and set your own pay. If you are ready to be your own CEO, Stratford University's life-changing Master's in Entrepreneurial Management covers the skills to launch your business from writing a solid business plan to financing, branding, and marketing. Choose from our convenient campus locations in Tyson's Corner and Woodbridge. Contact us today at stratford.edu. Stratford University, it's time to be more. Application and software developers shape our world. Those who design and build these systems are the leaders we follow. The School of Computer Information Systems at Stratford University's Tyson's Corner or Woodbridge campus offers programs with a real-world, hands-on education. In fact, many of today's Stratford IT grads are working in their chosen field. Make it work for you. Stratford University. Get working. Check us out on the web at stratford.edu. That's stratford.edu.
If it's technology, it's Tech Talk Radio. IT trends, software, the internet, and IT careers. Here's Dr. Richard Schertz of Stratford University with Tech Talk Radio.
And now it's time for Washington's most popular and longest-running radio game show, the Stratford University Pop Quiz. Now here's your host and star of our show. Nope, it's not Monty Hall. It's not Ed McMahon. It's not Dr. Richard Church. It's this guy right here.
And I would be that aforementioned guy right here. My name is Jim Russ. I am the adjunct professor for messing things up and lowering the academic bar here on your classroom of the airwaves, Tech Talk Radio. We just finished talking about Michael Sternhardt, the founder of Project Gutenberg. In order to win our fabulous prize of fine dining for two at the Escafe at Stratford University on the campus in Falls Church or at Cafe Karim on the Woodbridge campus, you need to tell me what Gutenberg's first name was, and you need to tell me what Gutenberg did. If you have the answer to that question, that two-parter, call us right now. Pick up the phone. If you're calling from west of Tacoma, Washington, it's 877-936-9333. From east of Urbana, Illinois, it's 877-936-9333. And for everyone else, the wild card line is 877-936-9333. The Pop Quiz from Tech Talk Radio.
All of you people on the Atkins diet, just put on the earmuffs because we are going to be talking about potatoes. Now, there are many different types of potatoes, and each has its best cooking method. Potatoes, as you know, are all about starch and water.
Yeah.
The cooking methods control the reaction between the two. Let's take a high-starch potato that's baked. The starch inside the potato absorbs water from other parts of the potato and swells, making a space between the cells and creating kind of a mealy, dry texture. When a potato is deep-fried, pan-fried, or roasted, the starch on the surface expands, sealing the edges in the surface, creating a crisp crust and keeping the interior moist.
Mm-hmm.
Boiling or low-starch potatoes do not absorb as much water, so the cell structure stays intact and the potato holds its shape. Now, there are several potato types. Russet potatoes have a very high starch content with low moisture. These potatoes are used for baking. These potatoes are, when baked, are mealy and fluffy, and they're the best choice for mashed potatoes, too.
That's really?
What I use russet potatoes for mashed. The reason, well, actually, I picked a russet. I like a big potato when I do mashed potatoes because it's easier to peel a big potato.
Sure.
There's less peeling.
Mm-hmm.
So it's just, I can peel more potatoes whenever I use a big potato.
Or you can make mashed potatoes and leave the skins on them.
No, but I don't.
You don't like that?
I don't like. Well, if you know those little red potatoes that sometimes they. Oh, no, I don't like that. I like my skins off.
Yeah. You're a traditionalist.
Now, I really am. Medium starch potatoes include Yukon Gold or Yellowfin potatoes. Now, they aren't as fluffy as russets, but have a great flavor. Yukon Gold potatoes, especially, they taste a little buttery when cooked.
Mm, now, I like that.
Potatoes with low starch content and high moisture include the red and white potatoes. These potatoes are most often boiled or roasted, so you wouldn't want to take a white potato and bake it, you see, because it's low starch. See, so you've actually got to pick your potatoes carefully, you know. They hold up well when they're cooked. You see, the low starch potatoes, they actually keep their structure when they're boiled or roasted. They're used in potato salad because of their creamy texture. They also hold together after being cooked. They don't fall apart.
Mm-hmm.
Now, then, of course, there are sweet potatoes and yams. Now, those are actually from two different tubers. Yams are a member
of the lily family.
I didn't know that.
Yeah. And sweet potatoes are a member of the morning glory family.
And I thought they were the same thing with two different names.
No, you got the lily family and the morning glory family. In the United States, you're most always buying sweet potatoes since true yams are not available. And there's about all you ever wanted to know about potatoes, especially if you are an Atkins diet person.
So, truly, the lower starch content and higher moisture are better potatoes for you if you're trying to avoid starch and carbs and stuff.
That's right. But if you want to have the go for the taste, the lower starch you tend to boil,
yep.
And the high starch you tend to bake.
So, Doc, how about the Shepherd Smith's big giant touchscreens?
Yeah, you know they had the big giant touchscreens. The Fox News released a video detailing a new set of. A new television set that included a number of analysts sitting in front of giant touchscreens. Now, these screens measure 55 inches and run Windows 8. It's running Microsoft's PPI display technology that came from its acquisition of Perceptive Pixel in July of 2012. I guess that's Perceptive Pixel Incorporated, PPI. And so they're running the Perceptive Pixel technology. Microsoft, through its acquisition, is now the OEM of some of the largest touchscreens in the world. They even have one that goes up to 80 inches.
Wow.
But I guess that was just too big for Shep.
You can't reach the top, right?
For Shep's studio, yeah. So according to Shep Smith, Fox News can toss images from any of the displays on air as they wish. And they've got a giant wall screen. They can throw them up to the giant wall screen. According to Microsoft, the multi-touch screens cost around $7,000 for each 55-inch model.
Wow. That's pretty amazing.
Microsoft is very proud that they actually made it into the studio. It's a great debut for their new technology.
It's Saturday morning, and you're listening to Tech Talk Radio on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM, 820 AM, 107.7 FM HD2. Stand by. More of Tech Talk right after this.
If it's technology, it's Tech Talk Radio. IT trends, software, the internet, and IT careers. More of Tech Talk Radio, presented by Stratford University, coming up in a moment.
It's time. Time to put your talents out there on your terms. Get full credit for your ideas and hard work and set your own pay. If you're ready to be your own CEO, Stratford University's life-changing Masters in Entrepreneurial Management program can show you how to develop and launch your business. From writing a solid business plan to financing, legal issues, staffing, even branding and marketing. Let Stratford show you the ropes and walk you over the pitfalls of running your own business. Choose from online or in-classroom courses at our convenient campus locations in Tyson's Corner and Woodbridge. It's time. Time to take charge of your future on your own terms. Contact us today at stratford.edu. That's stratford.edu. Or give us a call at 800-444-0804. That's 800-444-0804. Stratford University, it's time to be more. Application and software developers shape our world. Those who design and build these systems are the leaders we follow. The School of Computer Information Systems at Stratford University's Tyson's Corner or Woodbridge campus offers programs with a real-world, hands-on education. In fact, many of today's Stratford IT grads are working in their chosen field. Make it work for you. Stratford University. Get working. Check us out on the web at stratford.edu. That's stratford.edu. A rewarding future as a holistic caregiver or nurse practitioner. Combining the art of caring with the human science makes nursing today's breakout field. Stratford University's School of Nursing at the Tyson's Corner or Woodbridge campus offers a patient-centered approach with valuable core clinical training. Stratford provides a real-world education in nursing. In fact, many of today's Stratford nursing grads are working in their chosen fields. Make it work for you. Get working. Check us out on the web at stratford.edu. That's stratford.edu.
If it's technology, it's Tech Talk Radio. IT trends, software, the internet, and IT careers. Here's Dr. Richard Schertz of Stratford University with Tech Talk Radio.
Welcome back to Tech Talk Radio. We are in the virtual faculty lounge at Stratford University talking technology. European cloud users may start avoiding the U.S. cloud.
Really?
Yes, the European Union policymakers were skeptical about the safety of their corporations' data in the public cloud, but they began to accept it until the existence of PRISM, which, of course, is the NSA program for scooping up data that was revealed by Snowden.
Mm-hmm.
So the lawmakers in the European Union are now attaching broad amendments to the 2012 set of digital privacy regulations that could, if enacted, severely curtail and even outright block EU businesses and private citizens from using the U.S. cloud-based services. Now, there are several proposed amendments to the privacy regulations, including prohibiting the transfer of EU corporate data to U.S.-based clouds altogether. The new proposed regulations would also sanction European companies that ignored these rules and used the U.S. services anyway. The actions taken by the U.S. intelligence agency threatened to completely unravel the relationship between the European Union and the U.S. Previously, the EU had more or less allowed data to be stored in the U.S. cloud as long as the companies agreed to abide by EU privacy rules. But all that's gone out the window with PRISM. EU technology vendors are also pushing to have more cloud availability from their sources in their native countries. So they view this as a real opportunity. U.S. vendors are alarmed because it could be a big drop in U.S. cloud revenue. Now, Bitcoin users are a little bit upset with the FBI after the Silk Road seizure. Bitcoin users are retaliating after the FBI seized their digital currency as part of its case against the underground marketplace Silk Road. The FBI took down the Silk Road website and froze over 26,000 bitcoins. So Bitcoin is worth about $100, so that would be $2.6 million. $2.6 million worth of bitcoins. And they froze these bitcoins that were being held for customers as they made their transactions with Silk Road. FBI put these bitcoins into a separate holding address blockchain. Angered by this action, the supporters discovered the FBI's wallet details, the information necessary for performing transactions and sending public messages, and they began posting protests and making very small transactions with the seized bitcoins. You see, the FBI knew how to put it in a wallet. They didn't know how to stop transactions. Silk Road was an underground marketplace for many people, and it was used for drug-related and other illegal activities. The alleged owner, Ross Ulbricht, was arrested last week with charges for drug trafficking, computer hacking conspiracy, money laundering conspiracy, and for allegedly hiring a hitman to kill an employee.
Yikes.
So this is some heavy stuff. Yeah, Silk Road used both the Tor network, which is a peer-to-peer, the Tor network is the anonymous proxy server system that had been set up by U.S. Department of State, and Bitcoin as a way to keep transactions anonymous. The digital currency's value took a steep dive after the news hit, so it's probably not worth $100. Bitcoin's probably worth less than $100 now. Now, Bitcoin's appeal lies in the fact that it's anonymous, untraceable, and unregulated. These are the very attributes that make it appeal to a broad range of speculators, investors, entrepreneurs, and the criminal underworld.
Of course.
Including drug traffickers, terrorists, or anyone who wants to circumvent tax regulations. The coins are mined or discovered using computers and math, because Bitcoin does not rely on a centralized authorities for administration. It appeals philosophically to a certain segment of society, libertarians. It represents the spirit of libertarianism, free, unfettered, uncontrolled. The same attributes that make Bitcoin attractive to those anti-government philosophies also make it the perfect currency for illegal transactions. So the saga of the Bitcoin continues. But it's an interesting mathematical construction. Why does NSA love the Google Chromebook?
I don't know.
Well, it turns out you're online all the time. It's sort of like, why does NSA love your iPhone? You're online all the time. They can track with GPS where you're located. They got the metadata for what phone calls you make. We're actually sort of giving up our privacy. Well, Google and Intel announced a new group of upcoming Google Chromebooks based on Intel's Haswell architecture. Now, this is the new high-speed architecture that Intel's releasing, and so with the new Haswell architecture, these are going to be machines with much more capability. The idea of a cloud-tethered notebook, it means that you're always on the cloud because you've got to be on the cloud in order to do anything because you're driving all your documents, all your applications are on the cloud. So that means that they can always tell exactly where you're located because thanks to Verizon, when you're connected to the cloud, no matter where you are, they're giving up that data at NSA. So NSA can pinpoint, even though the Chromebook doesn't have GPS, mm-hmm. they can tell where you are by where you're connected to the cloud. And so the Haswell system will make many of these advantages for a high-speed processing much better. Chromebooks are really designed to allow users to do more than you can do on a tablet. Like the tablet, it's really hard to do applications. Sure. You don't have a mouse and a keyboard. So the Chromebook is really designed to be a step up in terms of usability over the tablet. But in order to be really usable over the tablet, you need to have higher speed processing, which is what this Haswell chip will do. But revelations about the NSA and the FBI's prisons programs have added doubts, particularly outside the U.S., about the wisdom of putting everything on the cloud. So until people figure that out, and actually until Google can find a way to encrypt data on their servers where only you control the encryption key, I think people are going to just be a little bit uneasy
mm-hmm.
because
mm-hmm.
Fort Meade, of course, NSA headquarters, could get it all. But I'm thinking the solution is going to be encrypt everything on the cloud so that it can't be de-encrypted, even if somebody does get the data. Okay, Elon Musk is doing a 3D printing of rocket parts. Now,
wow,
this is really interesting.
Is cool.
And there's a video which it's at entrepreneur.com, and I'll give it the link to it. What he does, he uses gestures. So he's got the rocket engine there, Elon Musk, of course, is CEO and chief technology officer of SpaceX. He's also the CEO and chief product architect of Tesla Motors. So he likes to design things. So he had the design of the rocket engine there, and he was like moving it around with his hands. And you watch it in the video. He basically modified the curvature on one of the parts just by moving his hands around. No computer screen, no keyboard, nothing. And then when he was finished, he sent it to a 3D printer, and he printed out the part in titanium. So this 3D printer would lay out this titanium powder, and then after it laid out the thin layer of titanium powder, a laser would come back over, and it would melt the powder to make thin metal.
Wow.
Then another layer of titanium powder, and so it built up this titanium three-dimensional rocket piece by piece.
Mm.
And it actually is a new way of doing manufacturing whenever you're developing things. It's quite impressive. Look at this YouTube video. I think it portends the future of where we are heading with technology.
That's pretty amazing. Yeah, you know, Doc, the old clock on the wall,
we're almost out of time. Listen, we love your emails. We want you to email us with us. We like a full mailbag.
Yes.
Email us to techtalk@stratford.edu. You can also sign up for the Tech Talk podcast by going to techtalkonline.com. You can sign up for the podcast. Every show back to the year 2000 is actually posted on the web. Or you can go to Apple iTunes and sign up for the podcast. And finally, go to Stratford.edu website, check out the programs, and let them know that you heard about them at Tech Talk Radio.
We'll see you next week here on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM, 820 AM, and 107.7 FM HD2.
This paid commercial may not represent the views of Hubbard Broadcasting Incorporated or Federal News Radio. Statements and opinions of this broadcast are solely those of individual contributors or advertisers as indicated. Federal News Radio does not take responsibility for those statements or opinions and accepts no responsibility or liability for any inaccuracy, errors, or omissions reported during this program.
WFED Washington, WWFD Frederick, WWWT-FM HD2 Manassas. This is Federal News Radio, on the air at 1500 AM and online at federalnewsradio.com, the only radio station in the world dedicated to serving the federal executive and government contractor. It's our mission to provide news and information that helps federal managers do their job better and help facilitate the business of government. Federal News Radio talks to the people who make government work to build a sense of federal community, discuss best practices, and explore lessons learned. Every weekday from 6 a.m. to 7 p.m., Federal News Radio interviews federal newsmakers one-on-one to explain how their news affects agencies and contractors. The Washington, D.C. home of Navy athletics. Nights and weekends, WFED broadcasts all the action of the Navy midshipmen, George Washington Colonials, American University Eagles, Washington Nationals, and the Washington Capitals. Federal News Radio, 1500 AM and federalnewsradio.com.
This paid commercial may not represent the views of Hubbard Broadcasting Incorporated or Federal News Radio. Statements and opinions of this broadcast are solely those of individual contributors or advertisers as indicated. Federal News Radio does not take responsibility.